step one's got to be useful to people. They've got to really love it. And if they don't, you're never going to have the opportunity to do step two, step three, step four, step five of that master plan.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.
It seems like we're consuming news content in one form or another on a 24/7 basis, yet how much innovation has there really been with respect to how we consume that news recently? One of the people trying to innovate that experience is Jeremy Fisher, who previously founded Wander and sold it to Yahoo in 2014. River is meant to rethink the way we consume content across the internet, pulling stories and content from across the web, including from publishers and social media, and then organizing that content based off of particular topics. We talked to Jeremy about River, the need for it, how a platform or service can prioritize content accordingly and figure out how to ethically develop a feed of news, and much more. So let's jump right in. So Jeremy, welcome to Future Proof.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
I always get a little bit, torn when there's somebody amazing to speak to who shares my first name, because it always feels a little bit weird to call other people by, I don't know, is that just me?
I feel you on that. Luckily our name is not terribly common, but every now and again.
Yeah, I feel bad for the Michaels and Davids out there, but just to kind of jump into things, I wanted to ask you, who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis in terms of how you define things?
My name is Jeremy Fisher. I'm the CEO of a company called River, and we make an interest graph-based content discovery platform. And as the CEO, I do a number of things. I'm primarily focused on product, so figuring out what features we're going to build, getting the team all on the same page, fundraising, vision, all that sort of fun stuff.
So tell me a little bit about River's origin story. I've read a little bit, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah. So I had started another company back in 2012, and we built a product called Days. And Days was essentially the proto story. So we were the first to come up with the idea of 24 hours forward chronological sharing. And the idea really was to bring context back into the social media space. At the time, people were sharing these isolated moments on Instagram or elsewhere. And our idea was, by sharing a whole day's worth of content, that would make a whole that was much greater than the sum of the parts. And keeping close to that space and what was happening across the industry in the intervening years, it felt like there was a similar lack of context afflicting how we consumed information, particularly real-time sorts of information that you'd find in Twitter or news apps and places like that. And so we saw an opportunity to bring context back into the conversation there. And that was essentially the genesis of River, really to give people really reliable, instant information on anything that they might be interested in.
Well, it's interesting because there is so much information overload these days, which is a major problem. And then obviously, I kind of almost have to play devil's advocate of, like, the solution to information overload is one more app, one more interface that people need to, consider making part of their daily workflow. So, I mean, how is River different, and how, in the way that you constructed it, how does it solve a problem for today's consumers?
Yeah, so I'll start with a little bit of just an overview of what we do. And as I mentioned before, we consider ourselves to be the first true interest graph-based content discovery platform. And what we do is instantly organize everything that people are talking about online, from sports to science, whether that's in the Times or on Twitter, into a personalized stream of bite-sized shareable stories that gets better as you use it. And we built the product for what we consider to be a very modern type of consumer. These are people who skim rather than go deep, who want to triangulate multiple perspectives to build trust. And I think that's a key element that answers your question, is that there obviously is a lot of competition in the broader space. But I think that what we were seeing is that having isolated viewpoints that are shared amidst puppy photos and the new baby and the anniversary and all the other social stuff that's happening is not a great way to consume information. And it creates all sorts of downstream problems, particularly around misinformation because this stuff is shared out of context. You don't really know often where it's coming from, and that creates all sorts of problems that we can get into. We also wanted to create something that felt more modern from a user experience perspective. So something that feels more like Stories or Snapchat or TikTok than it does like a traditional newspaper or news app. And we also built it for people who get news from non-traditional formats and platforms, whether that's social posts, GIFs, memes, et cetera. And so I think one was this triangulation point that I brought up, right? When you present information out of context to people, that creates this need to put a warning label on it or try to provide some additional context. And that's one approach. In our view, that's actually a band-aid on this issue. A better solve, and the solve that we've taken, is to use machine learning and various other techniques to figure out what a given piece of content is about, and then situate that piece of content alongside all the other pieces of content from different publishers that are on that same topic. And then the user gets to see for themselves, is this an outlier view? Is this a consensus view? So for instance, if you're consuming a piece of content that's about the outcome of the election, well, most of the headlines are going to say that Joe Biden won. And if you have a single document which says Trump won, that's going to look like an outlier when it's alongside all of these other pieces of content from reliable sources. But if you've just presented that one tweet that says Trump won, and that's all that somebody's consuming on this, well, that becomes the point where you might need a warning label or something like that. So we try to avoid that whole issue by giving people the full breadth of the picture on any given topic, and then ranking that appropriately based on the credibility of the source and whatnot.
That was actually something that I had wanted to ask you about later, but I'm going to jump to it now, is, you know, how a platform or service like yours prioritizes content accordingly and figures out how to ethically develop a feed of news. And I mean, some people are like, what, business and ethics? But I mean, honestly, it is a thing that's coming up more and more, which is, you know, you obviously want to present something that doesn't just, let's say, reinforce the worldview of the founders, you know, or the developers. So how do you kind of balance that or solve that, if you will?
So there's a bunch of different approaches that we take. We try to figure out objective signals, because the problem that you describe of just reinforcing the worldview of whoever made the platform is definitely something to be aware of. So we try to avoid taking editorial decisions, for instance, saying we happen to like the New York Times over Newsweek, for instance, or something like that. So we use a couple different things. One are variations on an algorithm that you might be familiar with, which is called PageRank. And this was originally developed by Google. We've modernized that in various ways and adapted it to fit our purposes. And so what we're doing is we're going out and we're looking at essentially the number of citations that any given publisher might have. And we do that on a per category basis. So first of all, let's say we ingest a tweet. We're going to look at who published that tweet. And we're going to look at, is that user connected to a particular domain? Who follows that account? What domains mention that domain? And so we're building a graph of connections, and we're able to use that graph to figure out what the important nodes are in that on a per category basis. And so we can say, for instance, Sports Illustrated is cited on sports topics the most compared to other publications. So that gives us a sense that essentially all the people who write about the topic of sports have voted in the way that they're writing about things and in the way that they're linking to other sources. And they've implicitly said that Sports Illustrated is a really reliable source of information in this particular category. And so we're going to use information like that. We're going to combine it with various other signals, for instance, number of followers, engagement, things like that, and then measures of how people are engaging with that content in our own service to create a ranking on a per category basis and a per topic basis.
What do you think, by the way, about the idea of the average person, or not even average person, but essentially people figuring out how algorithms work and then just trying to gamify things a little bit? You know, obviously, if you're the Googles of the world, you keep on responding to it and you keep finding ways to patch those holes. But how do you, especially as a newer player, try to, you know, deal with that and the fact that there are people out there who are understand that algorithms are at work and they're trying to circumvent in as much as possible and, you know, get around algorithms in order to be present in news feeds?
Yeah, so we're a bit lucky when it comes to that because we're downstream of the platforms that people are actually uploading content to. So whatever steps the Googles and the Twitters of the world are taking, we benefit from what they're doing because it has to get published to one of those places first before we're ingesting it. So nobody's publishing directly. So we get to layer on all of our own measures of this stuff on top of what they're already doing. So it's pretty hard to game what we're doing because first you'd have to game Twitter and game Google and game all these other platforms. And because we're aggregating across all of those, you can't just game one platform. You have to game all of them. And we're looking at all those signals to really figure out, okay, something's off. Something is off here. And so it's quite hard to do. It's much easier to game if you have a single platform in mind and you're just uploading directly there.
By the way, speaking of being off, I feel like the last year has been off for a lot of us. And you obviously launched at a really interesting time. Did the pandemic and the events of 2020 inform the way you developed or, you know, went to market at all?
Yeah. So, I mean, it certainly impacted a lot of how we had to organize ourselves as a company. We were not a remote company at all. We were a company that was based out of a really great loft in Soho, and we worked alongside of each other. And so we hadn't hired or planned to be a remote first company. And so there's definitely a learning curve associated with that. We were really fortunate in terms of people had home situations that allowed them to work pretty seamlessly from their apartments. We are building a product that doesn't have a physical world component to it, right? So it's a purely digital product. We were still very much in the R&D phase. And so we were able to navigate that transition pretty seamlessly from a work perspective. We did end up responding to what was happening in the broader world by building a product called Overflow, which was a very direct response to how we saw people sharing during the pandemic and also during the protests around George Floyd. And so that was definitely very, very specifically connected to that. And we were building a product, our core product River, in response to a lot of the trends that I think have become really important in the wake of what's happened, particularly politically. So all of those things that have allowed us to get to the point that we are as a broader culture and society are things that we had in mind and that we were responding to with the way that we were building our product. So specifically around misinformation, how do people get reliable information quickly? I think those things were already present if you were looking for them. And so that very much was informing our approach ahead of time. And I think certainly positioned us very well to do well in the market once we did launch.
Which I think brings up the point of, you know, trying to be an innovator, launching a new product and, you know, garnering 10 million or so in funding in the middle of a pandemic. Is it harder to raise those funds and convince people that this is something that people need right now? Did it make it easier? You know, all of the above?
So I think for us, it had somewhat negligible impact from that perspective initially, because I've been doing this as an entrepreneur for a very long time. And so I had the benefit and the good fortune of having many, many well-established relationships already. I have to imagine if you're a first-time entrepreneur and you've never met VCs in person, to do a fundraise entirely virtually without ever having built that in-person rapport would have been quite difficult.
Probably, I would imagine that there are a lot of VCs that I've spoken to, by the way, who just had never done a deal like that sight unseen before. It was like you would fly from New York to California for a half hour meeting.
Right, right. And I definitely had that experience in the past. And so I think if anything, it may have been net beneficial for us because it's easier to allocate capital, I have to imagine, to companies and entrepreneurs that you already have those relationships with going into it. It certainly didn't feel like it hurt us or was a particular challenge, but I can imagine many scenarios in which it would have been.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's funny because I remember Wander, you know, from back in the day, and you sold Wander to Yahoo back in 2014, I believe. And so obviously good track record there, like you were just alluding to. But how does an entrepreneur figure out how to create something that's going to be bigger in the years to come, but then also get the timing right, you know, because I've spoken to a lot of people who developed something that's very similar to Clubhouse, except they did it 8 years too early, let's say, right? So it's a combination of those two things, figuring out that this is a thing that's going to be bigger, but then also getting the timing right. How do you do that? And what advice do you have for other people trying to master that skill?
Timing is so hard. It's at the end of the day, it almost ends up being everything. I think often the right time is when it feels like it's already too late, right? So if you look at Facebook, Facebook wasn't the first social network. MySpace was hugely dominant. If you look at Google, many search engines. Who needed another search engine at the time? So I think looking at the market at that point, it would have been very easy to say, oh, it's too late. It usually ends up never being too late. So I think the real risk is being too early. And so it can often be helpful to have that feeling of, oh, it's too late. And certainly the case for us in the space that we're in, far from the first people to try to do this. So I think if anything, it's the question would be, don't you think it's too late? There's so much other competition in this space. But I think there's always opportunities, and all those companies that come first really pave the way for whoever ends up becoming super successful.
I was going to say, I think, yeah, in some ways, you're just learning from all of their mistakes. And I've said even before, if I ever write a third book, I would want to call it First Mover Disadvantage, because there are so many different examples of companies, like you mentioned, like the Friendsters and MySpaces of the world, that had an innovation first. They felt, you know, they screwed up, and then some other company gets to learn from that mistake. It's basically free R&D that, you know, you've been able to conduct by watching all of the failings of anybody who you're trying to compete against.
And I want to answer the other part of your question, which is, how do you build something that you think is going to be bigger and more successful? Because I think the answer there is somewhat counterintuitive. And it's not by building a product with a bigger surface area or trying to come up with a bigger vision. I think it's really about remaining laser focused. What people miss often is that your first version has to really kill it. You can have some grand 5-year vision, but the thing that's going to get you from step one to step two is step one. So step one's got to be useful to people. They've got to really love it. And if they don't, you're never going to have the opportunity to do step two, step three, step four, step five of that master plan. And so I think it's great to think a little bit about, well, what happens if everything with this goes right? And imagine how the world might be different if this really took off. And Airbnb always comes to mind as a great example of what that might look like. So you start out with that product where people are really renting floor space in somebody's apartment. And you say, well, what if this really took off? Well, maybe we don't need hotels anymore, right? We've completely decentralized hospitality. But then once you've thought of that, you should probably just forget about the grand vision for a few months and just nail whatever that first version is, because that's what you're going to put into the market. That's what people are going to have to use.
It's interesting because a lot of people, obviously, they talk about the idea of that minimum viable product. And, you know, you want to launch something like that and get feedback. And, you know, I've always seen that there's a certain rationale there. But of course, when, you know, you're thinking about the idea of PR and timing and trying to really get people to use something, it's like you don't want to really pull that marketing and PR lever and then have people show up to the party, realize it's not ready. And then, you know, what are the odds that you're going to get them to give you a second try 6 months from now? So to me, it's like, find a way to have something that is good enough that you can get feedback and that you're not going to churn those early adopters, or, you know, just don't have a major push and try to make it that big moment unless you're ready for that big moment.
People focus too much on the minimal part of that and not enough on the viable part. So many minimal things are not actually viable. So you have to build something that is in fact viable.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to ask you just before, I know you have to go in a sec, but I heard you say in an interview that the greatest opportunities emerge during periods of disruption, which obviously, I feel like this year is a perfect example of that. And I think we'll probably see a lot of really interesting products and innovations come out of it, some that we've seen and probably some that, you know, they're just in that fruition stage right now where people are just ideating. But how does an innovator act on that advice? Because I thought that was a really great quote.
So periods of disruption often cause permanent changes in our habits and how we organize our lives. And things very often don't go back to the way they were before after we've gotten a taste of what this new reality is. So work from home or just spending a lot of time at home doing things over Zoom is a great example of that. So what's been unlocked from that? Well, at-home fitness in various ways. Obviously, companies like Peloton were already in the market, but this was an escape velocity moment for a Peloton or a Mirror. And I imagine that there's companies being started now that are taking advantage of that same trend, whether that's going to be in cooking or whether that's in wellness or meditation or any one of a number of other spaces. And so people have built this habit that a very wide variety of people have built this habit that was probably a pretty niche behavior before. And so you've gotten a taste of it, you've gotten comfortable with it, and you're like, actually, I don't really need to go to Equinox anymore. Now I'm in the market for all sorts of at-home experiences. What other sorts of at-home experiences might there be? So there's this social change and cultural change that enables things to become viable that may not have been viable or may not have been anything more than niche before is one thing that I think helps you in a period of disruption. Another is the employment markets get all messed up. So you have access to talent that you might not have had before because people have been laid off or lost jobs. Companies have gone out of business. So their wages have fallen. So it now becomes cheaper and more reasonable to build a team during these periods of disruption or recession or whatever than it would have been otherwise. And capital becomes more comfortable with new models because it starts to say, oh, well, whatever view of the world that we had before is not as tenable as we thought it was. Turns out subprime mortgages, not a good place to invest. So where else are we going to put our capital? Who's doing interesting, innovative things? Who's positioned to take advantage of future disruption? So all sorts of startups that are doing concierge or at home or telehealth, any of that around medicine now becomes really interesting because this put a marker in people's minds that this type of event is not likely to be the last one of these. And so how do we start to prepare for the next one? That's a ton of new business opportunities that have emerged out of that.
I've told a lot of people, and they don't like when I joke about this, but I said, you know, all of this COVID-19 stuff, the one good thing is that I'm going to be really prepared for COVID-23.
That's right.
But you're right, though. All the data does point to, you know, other periods like this in our future, and better to be a little too ready for it than the opposite, I guess you could say. But
my cabinet of tuna fish is ready to go.
Definitely. And make sure you have a second can opener. That's the thing. You can't forget the second one because you need a backup. But Jeremy, this was fantastic. And I think that, you know, I have played around with the app. I enjoy it. I think a lot of people will get a good amount out of checking it out and this conversation as well. So thanks so much for making the time.
It was a real pleasure.
Thanks again to Jeremy for making the time. If you'd like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get this show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio, and assistant producer Aaron Cohen. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.